Good afternoon. This is Read Me Something You Love, and edition of Read Me Something You Love, because I am sitting a stone's throw away from Waterstones Piccadilly Circus, where tonight Jean Kwok is going to have her short story, Where the Gods Fly, read aloud. As part of the selection of readings that are happening at the moment for the Sunday Times EFG Short Story Award 2012, this fantastic short story award. And Jean very kindly has agreed to do a Read Me Something You Love. So welcome, Jean, and thank you so much.
Well, I love being here, Steve, and it's such a joy to read something I love that I did not write. So it's a great pleasure to read something that I, you know, a story that I care about and admire, and not have the responsibility of being something that I wrote myself. Probably somewhere around high school or university, I had read the story, and it made a tremendous impact on me because it's written by a working class mother worrying about her daughter. And just even though she's not Chinese and she's not an immigrant, her situation, that situation of feeling outside of her daughter's life, of loving someone so much and yet no longer being a part of their world, was something that spoke to me as a Chinese immigrant very powerfully.
Now, I'm very struck by you describing, giving that précis of the story, that you could be talking word for word about your story, Where the Gods Fly. And I'm just wondering, obviously reading it and thinking, wow, the parallels are so apparent and the stories do seem to sort of talk to each other. I was wondering if that was a conscious thing when you were writing Where the Gods Fly.
No, it was. No, it absolutely was. Where the Gods Fly was inspired by this great American classic story, I Stand Here Ironing. I Stand Here Ironing by Tilly Olson. I stand here ironing, and what you asked me moves tormented back and forth with the iron. I wish you would manage the time to come in and talk with me about your daughter. I'm sure you can help me understand her. She's a youngster who needs help and whom I'm deeply interested in helping. Who needs help? Even if I came, what good would it do? You think because I am her mother, I have a key? Or that in some way you could use me as a key? She has lived for 19 years. There is all that life has happened outside of me, beyond me. And when is there time to remember, to sift, to weigh, to estimate, to total? I will start, and there will be an interruption, and I will have to gather it all together again. Or I will become engulfed with all I did or did not do, with what should have been and what cannot be helped. She was a beautiful baby, the first and only one of our five that was beautiful at birth. You do not guess how new and uneasy her tendency in her now loveliness. You did not know her all those years she was thought homely, or see her poring over her baby pictures, making me tell her over and over how beautiful she had been and would be, I would tell her, and was now to the seeing eye. But the seeing eyes were few or non-existent, including mine. I nursed her. They feel that's important nowadays. I nursed all the children, but with her, with all the fierce rigidity of first motherhood, I did like the books then said. Though her cries battered me to trembling and my breasts ached with swollenness, I waited till the clock decreed. Why do I put that first? I do not even know if it matters or if it explains anything. She was a beautiful baby. She blew shining bubbles of sound. She loved motion, loved light, loved color and music and textures. She would lie on the floor in her blue overalls, patting the surface so hard in ecstasy, her hands and feet would blur. She was a miracle to me, but when she was 8 months old, I had to leave her daytimes with the women downstairs, to whom she was no miracle at all, for I worked or looked for work, and for Emily's father, who, quote, could no longer endure, he wrote in his goodbye note, sharing want with us. I was 19. It was the pre-relief, pre-WPA world of the Depression. I would start running as soon as I got off the streetcar, running up the stairs, the place smelling sour, and awake or asleep to startle awake. When she saw me, she would break into a clogged weeping that could not be comforted, a weeping I can hear yet. After a while, I found a job hashing at night so I could be with her days, and it was better. But I came to where I had to bring her to family and leave her. It took a long time to raise the money for her fare back. Then she got chicken pox and I had to wait longer. When she finally came, I hardly knew her, walking quick and nervous like her father, looking like her father, thin and dressed in a shoddy red that yellowed her skin and glared at the pockmarks. All the baby loveliness gone. She was 2. Old enough for nursery school, they said, and I did not know then what I did now. The fatigue of the long day and the lacerations of group life in the kinds of nurseries that are only parking places for children. Except that it would have made no difference if I had known. It was the only place there was. It was the only way we could be together, the only way I could hold a job. And even without knowing, I knew. I knew the teacher that was evil, because all these years it has curdled into my memory. The little boy hunched in the corner, her rasp. Why aren't you outside? Because Alvin hits you? That's no reason. Go out, scaredy. I knew Emily hated it, even if she did not clutch and implore, don't go, mommy, like the other children mornings. She always had a reason why we should stay home. Mama, you look sick. Mama, I feel sick. Mama, the teachers aren't there today. They're sick. Mama, we can't go. There was a fire there last night. Mama, it's a holiday today. No school, they told me. But never a direct protest, never rebellion. I think of our others in their 3-4-year-oldness, the explosions, the tempers, the denunciations, the demands, and I feel suddenly ill. I put down the iron. What in me demanded that goodness in her? And what was the cost to her of such goodness? The old man living in the back once said in his gentle way, you should smile more at Emily when you look at her. What was in my face when I looked at her? I loved her. There were all the acts of love. It was only with the others I remembered what he said, and it was the face of joy and not of care or tightness or worry I turned to. Too late for Emily. She does not smile easily, let alone almost always, as her brothers and sisters do. Her face is closed and somber, but when she wants, how fluid. You must have seen it in her pantomimes. You spoke of her rare gift for comedy on the stage that rouses laughter out of the audience so dear they applaud and applaud and do not want to let her go.
Thank you. So where are we? The beginning of the story.
I think Tilly Olson has set up the story really beautifully, where you know that there is a girl, she's 19, she's deeply loved by her mother, and yet alienated from her mother. You know, that you can hear that she had a difficult childhood, they didn't have enough money, and is a mother who did her best, and that meant that it was not enough, but it was still the best that she could do.
Mm. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? In the first couple of paragraphs, the first paragraph, she says, you think because I am her mother I have a key, or that in some way you could use me as a key. And it seems like a very sort of post-Freudian line, doesn't it? That we now turn to the mothers, the sins, the omissions of the mothers to kind of find out where it's gone wrong for the daughters rather than the other way around. I wonder how you feel about that.
Well, I think that, you know, a mother-daughter relationship is always so complicated. And, you know, it's so filled with love and tenderness and so many good intentions, and yet it can so often fail, especially because it is so important. You know, it is, I think the daughter needs so much from the mother, and at a certain point, the mother cannot provide it, you know, either because of an emotional lack or because of a physical lack, a monetary lack. And here, I think what touches me so much about this situation, that it is so much about a mother who loved the baby so very, very much, but yet didn't have the money, needed to work, needed to leave her alone, and had worry and care, and through that was not able to be the person or the mother that she wanted to be for her daughter.
We forget, don't we, when we get sort of judgmental about parents, the circumstances.
This story spoke to me so much because, you know, I grew up in poverty as well, and you know, I had always known how hard it was for my mother, but the difficulty is that you are still the child.
And I think it also very poignantly brings out in this first part how much as mothers, I was going to say as mothers, well, I'm not a mother, but how much as parents we are, whether we know it or not, constricted by whatever child-raising zeitgeist is out there at the moment. I mean, she says, doesn't she? She says, though her cries battered me to trembling and my breasts ache with swollenness, I waited till the clock decreed. Now, why did she wait until the clock decreed? Presumably, there's some, you know, Dr. Spock or one of, I don't know who was reigning in Tilly Olson's day.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I do have two children. You know, they are now 5 and 8, and I was very conscious of that. Indeed, that there is kind of a wisdom of, well, you know, he's 2 years old. He's old enough to go to, you know, this system at this time for that much time, and I've always been skeptical of it. I think try to listen to wisdom, but in the end, I think that as a parent, you have to listen to your own heart. And because I am Chinese and I live in Holland, so we bring up our kids in Holland. My husband is Dutch. We always have these different systems, you know, and we don't choose one or the other, because sometimes I think the Dutch way is wonderful, and I think sometimes the Chinese way is wonderful. But for example, in Holland, you know, the kids really sleep in their own rooms. I don't know how that is in England, but they sleep in their own rooms from birth. You know, they have their own room and they sleep in it. Our kids had their own rooms, but when they cried or when they were scared or, you know, really very much of the time when they were little, they just came and slept with us. We would just bring them into our own bed. And that's something very Chinese, that it's all right to have the child be with the parents when they are scared. So I think when you have kind of different cultural systems, you do have the good fortune of being able to choose and knowing there is a choice.
I think that some of the tragedy here is that necessary attachment that is needed to form the relationship between the child and the caregiver. As you say, partly it's not forged because of circumstance, but partly it's not forged because of ignorance or because of not actually following instinct. Mm-hmm. Because she has this instinctual pull, doesn't she, to feed her child, to give a child a particular kind of attention, and she's stopping herself.
That's right. And what I like so much about that moment is that she feels guilty about it, but you can tell that actually it's one of the things that tells you how much she loves that child, you know, that she wanted the best for it and she was going to do what was right. And then she realizes later, no, it actually wasn't right. And both of those facets show you how much she loves that baby.
Mm. Shall we continue reading?
Yes. Where does it come from, that comedy? There was none of it in her when she came back to me that second time, after I had had to send her away again. She had a new daddy now to learn to love, and I think perhaps it was a better time. Except when we left her alone nights, telling ourselves she was old enough. "Can't you go some other time, Mommy, like tomorrow?" she would ask. "Will it be just a little while you'll be gone? Do you promise?" The time we came back, the front door open, the clock on the floor in the hall. She, rigid awake. "It wasn't just a little while. I didn't cry. 3 times I called you, just 3 times, and then I ran downstairs to open the door so you could come faster. The clock talked loud. I threw it away. It scared me what it talked." She said the clock talked loud again that night I went to the hospital to have Susan. She was delirious with the fever that comes before red measles, but she was fully conscious all the week I was gone, and the week after we were home, when she could not come near the new baby or me. She did not get well. She stayed skeleton thin, not wanting to eat, and night after night she had nightmares. She would call for me, and I would rouse from exhaustion to sleepily call back, "You're all right, darling. Go back to sleep. It's just a dream." And if she still called, in a sterner voice, "Now go to sleep, Emily. There's nothing to hurt you." Twice, only twice, when I had to get up for Susan anyhow, I went in to sit with her. Now, when it is too late, as if she would let me hold and comfort her like I do the others, I get up and go to her at once, at her moan or restless stirring. "Are you awake, Emily? Can I get you something?" And the answer is always the same. "No, I'm all right. Go back to sleep, Mother." They persuaded me at the clinic to send her away to a convalescent home in the country where she can have the kind of food and care you can't manage for her, and you'll be free to concentrate on the new baby. They still send children to that place. I see pictures on the society page of sleek young women planning affairs to raise money for it, or dancing at the affairs, or decorating Easter eggs, or filling Christmas stockings for the children. They never have a picture of the children, so I do not know if the girls still wear those gigantic red bows and the ravaged looks on every other Sunday when parents can come to visit unless otherwise notified, as we were notified the first 6 weeks. Oh, it is a handsome place, green lawns and tall trees and fluted flower beds. High up on the balconies of each cottage, the children stand, the girls in their red bows and white dresses, the boys in white suits and giant red ties. The parents stand below, shrieking up to be heard, and the children shriek down to be heard, and between them the invisible wall, not to be contaminated by parental germs or physical affection. There was a tiny girl who always stood hand in hand with Emily. Her parents never came. One visit, she was gone. "They moved her to Rose Cottage," Emily shouted in explanation. "They don't like you to love anybody here." She wrote once a week, the labored writing of a 7-year-old. "I am fine. How is the baby? If I write my letter nicely, I will have a star. Love." There was never a star. We wrote every other day, letters she could never hold or keep, but only hear read once. We simply do not have room for children to keep any personal possessions, they patiently explained when we pieced one Sunday shrieking together to plead how much it would mean to Emily, who loved to keep things, to be allowed to keep her letters and cards. Each visit she looked frailer. "She isn't eating," they told us. "They had runny eggs for breakfast or mush with lumps," Emily said later. "I'd hold it in my mouth and not swallow. Nothing ever tasted good, just when they had chicken." It took us 8 months to get her released home, and the fact that she gained back so little of her 7 lost pounds convinced the social worker. "I used to try to hold and love her after she came back, but her body would stay stiff, and after a while she'd push away. She ate little. Food sickened her, and I think much of life, too. Oh, she had physical lightness and brightness, twinkling by on skates, bouncing like a ball up and down over the jump rope, skimming over the hill, but these were momentary. She fretted about her appearance, thin and dark and foreign-looking, at a time when every little girl was supposed to look, or thought she should look, a chubby blonde replica of Shirley Temple. The doorbell sometimes rang for her, but no one seemed to come and play in the house or be a best friend, maybe because we moved so much. There was a boy she loved painfully through two school semesters. Months later, she told me how she had taken pennies from my purse to buy him candy. Licorice was his favorite, and I bought him some every day, but he still liked Jennifer better than me. Why, Mommy? The kind of question for which there is no answer. School was a worry to her. She was not glib or quick in a world where glibness and quickness were easily confused with the ability to learn. To her overworked and exasperated teachers, she was an over-conscientious, slow learner who kept trying to catch up and was absent entirely too often. I let her be absent, although sometimes the illness was imaginary. How different from my now strictness about attendance with the others. I wasn't working. We had a new baby. I was home anyhow. Sometimes, after Susan grew old enough, I would keep her home from school, too, to have them all together. Mostly, Emily had asthma, and her breathing, harsh and labored, would fill the house with a curiously tranquil sound. I would bring the two old dresser mirrors and her boxes of collections to her bed. She would collect beads and single earrings, bottle tops and shells, dried flowers and pebbles, old postcards and scraps, all sorts of oddments. Then she and Susan would play kingdom, setting up landscapes and furniture, peopling them with action. Those were the only times of peaceful companionship between her and Susan. I have edged away from it, that poisonous feeling between them, that terrible balancing of hurts and needs I had to do between the two, and did so badly those earlier years. Oh, there are conflicts between the others too, each one human, needing, demanding, hurting, taking. But only between Emily and Susan, no, Emily toward Susan, that was corroding resentment. It seemed so obvious on the surface, yet it was not obvious. Susan, the second child. Susan, golden and curly-haired and chubby, quick and articulate and assured, everything in appearance and manner Emily was not. Susan, not able to resist Emily's precious things, losing or sometimes clumsily breaking them. Susan telling jokes and riddles to company for applause, while Emily sat silent to say to me later, "That was my riddle, Mother. I told it to Susan." Susan, who, for all the 5 years difference in age, was just a year behind Emily in developing physically.
Thank you. I'm really struck by that line, you know, about that scene where the parents are shrieking at the children shrieking, parents shrieking down, the children shrieking up, and this invisible wall not to be contaminated by parental germs or physical affection. You know, that sense of institutions and bureaucracy sort of getting in the way of us trying to be human.
I think that's very true. And I think also that in the old days, you know, the kind of cuddling and kissing and hugging that we have with children was, you know, it was less. I think in generations ago, children were treated more like little adults that needed to stand by the table while the adults ate. And, you know, I like things much better the way they are now. I'm glad that we, you know, cuddle and love them the way they need to be. But that is, you know, you have the institutions, but I think it was also just in almost every culture was a greater distance between parents and children.
Mm-hmm. And yet it seems that Susan sort of got some of that care and attention that she needed, and Emily knows that, doesn't she? And that's where the sort of this resentment comes in, that Susan got what she needed.
I think that's very true. And Susan was, of course, born into an easier time, an easier place in the lives of that family. And, you know, sometimes, you know, part of your character is also inborn. Emily just had a much more difficult youth and maybe was just a different sort of a child, maybe more introverted, more difficult in getting along with young children. And then you can imagine that it's very easy to resent a second child that seems to have it easy. And I love the way in the story how there's just such an efficient and sparing use of details, but you feel like you know these children. And she covers, Tilly Olson covers a tremendous span of time, but you don't feel shortchanged. You know, you feel that you see those years rolling by. You know, she picks out just enough moments that you feel that you see those children growing up the way they do.
Yeah, I mean, it does feel incredibly intimate. I'm not sure how much of that is also me kind of projecting some of the similarities of my life and the dynamics, you know, between my brother and some of that onto this. I suppose I was also wondering, kind of, when you were talking, well, where do you stand on the sort of the nature-nurture debate? Because it's true that there are sort of certain things that are temperamental, but that are almost genetic, and yet, you know, as I say, I had a fairly similar early years to these, and I'm much more of an Emily than a Susan.
I was wondering. I wanted to ask you.
Yes,
ah,
I am.
Yeah.
And my brother had more of the Susan, you know, second child, more of the sort of the Susan experience, and is more a Susan than an Emily. So, which would seem to suggest that nurture is stronger than nature.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm the youngest of seven, and I'm definitely more an Emily than a Susan as well. So I you know, I have to say, before I had children myself, I was firmly on the side of nurture. I was 100% nurture. And now that I do have children, I also really believe in nature. I think that we are born with our souls and are the way we are, but the way we are brought up can greatly influence what we think of ourselves and how we develop. I think that the core is there. I think the children are different. That if you took my second child and I put him first and, you know, flipped the birth order around, I'm quite sure that they would still be the people that they are. But I do think that the environment you bring them up in makes a great deal of difference to how easy or how difficult it is for that child to grow up and to be happy and to believe in themselves and to kind of see what their own gifts are. And that's, you know, that's kind of a part of what every parent, I think that's your task as a parent, to show your child how wonderful it is in its uniqueness. And it's also easy to forget because children are exasperating and exhausting, even when you're not working 12 hours a day, you know, even when you have a good job and a good life, they're also exhausting. And, you know, I think it is something that stories like this help us to remember, is to be kind of a great parent to your child.
I think that's beautifully expressed. I'm aware of the fact that as soon as we finish reading and recording, you are going to be doing some ironing. So maybe we should, it's kind of curious, isn't it? It really is, you know, we start with the ironing in the story, and I know that as soon as I walk out of this door, you'll be kind of pulling out the ironing board.
Right. Well, you know, I thought of that, Steve, because, you know, just, you know, to explain to people who are listening, what happened is, of course, I flew into London this morning, and I have had interviews back to back, and then Steve had a group he had to do, so he was going to come a little bit later than we thought, and so because of that, I wrote him this email where I said, well, you know, I will just do my ironing before you come so that I'm a bit more prepared. And indeed, yes, the moment you leave, I'm going to iron what I'm going to wear tonight.
Yeah. So I'm very aware of that. and I do not want to keep you from your ironing. So let's continue reading.
I will finish the story. I am glad for that slow physical development that widened the difference between her and her contemporaries, though she suffered over it. She was too vulnerable for that terrible world of youthful competition, of preening and parading, of constant measuring of yourself against every other, of envy, if I had that copper hair, if I had that skin. She tormented herself enough about not looking like the others. There was enough of the unsureness, the having to be conscious of words before you speak, the constant caring, what are they thinking of me, without having it all magnified by the merciless physical drives. Ronnie is calling. He is wet and I change him. It is rare there is such a cry now. That time of motherhood is almost behind me, when the ear is not one's own, but must always be racked and listening for the child cry, the child call. We sit for a while and I hold him, looking out over the city spread in charcoal with its soft aisles of light. Sugarly, he breathes and curls closer. I carry him back to bed, asleep. Sugarly, a funny word, a family word, inherited from Emily, invented by her to say comfort. In this and other ways, she leaves her seal, I would say aloud, and startle at my saying it. What do I mean? What did I start to gather together to try and make coherent? I was at the terrible growing years, war years. I do not remember them well. I was working. There were four smaller ones now. There was not time for her. She had to help be a mother and housekeeper and shopper. She had to set her seal. Mornings of crisis and near hysteria, trying to get lunches packed, hair combed, coats and shoes found, everyone to school or childcare on time, the baby ready for transportation. And always the paper scribbled on by a smaller one, the book looked at by Susan, then mislaid, the homework not done. Running out to that huge school where she was won, she was lost, she was a drop, suffering over the unpreparedness, stammering and unsure in her classes. There was so little time left at night after the kids were bedded down. She would struggle over books, always eating. It was in those years she developed her enormous appetite that is legendary in our family, and I would be ironing or preparing food for the next day or writing V-mail to Bill or tending the baby. Sometimes to make me laugh or out of her despair, she would imitate happenings at school. I think I said once, "Why don't you do something like this in the school amateur show?" One morning she phoned me at work, hardly understandable through the weeping. "Mother, I did it. I won, I won. They gave me first prize. They clapped and clapped and wouldn't let me go." Now suddenly she was somebody, and as imprisoned in her difference as she had been in anonymity. She began to be asked to perform at other high schools, even colleges, then at city and statewide affairs. The first one we went to, I only recognized her that first moment when, thin, shy, she almost drowned herself into the curtains. Then, was this Emily? The control, the command, the convulsing and deadly clowning, the spell, then the roaring, the stamping audience, unwilling to let this rare and precious laughter out of their lives. Afterwards, "You ought to do something about her with a gift like that. But without money or knowing how, what does one do?" We have left it all to her, and the gift has often eddied inside, clogged and clotted, as been used and growing. She is coming. She runs up the stairs two at a time with her light, graceful step, and I know she is happy tonight. Whatever it was that occasioned your call did not happen today. "Aren't you ever going to finish ironing, Mother? Whistler painted his mother in a rocker. I'd have to paint mine standing over an ironing board." This is one of her communicative nights, and she tells me everything and nothing as she fixes herself a plate of food out of the icebox. She is so lovely, Why did you want to come up at all? Why were you concerned? She will find her way. She starts up the stairs to bed. Don't get me up with the rest in the morning. But I thought you were having midterms. Oh, those! She comes back in, kisses me, and says quite lightly, in a couple of years, when we'll all be Adam dead, they won't matter a bit. She has said it before. She believes it. But because I have been dredging the past, and all that compounds a human being is so heavy and meaningful in me, I cannot endure it tonight. I will never total it all. I will never come to say, she was a child seldom smiled at. Her father left me before she was a year old. I had to work her first 6 years when there was work, or I sent her home and to his relatives. There were years she had care she hated. She was dark and thin and foreign-looking, in a world where the prestige went to blondness and curly hair and dimples. She was slow where glibness was prized. She was a child of anxious, not proud, love. We were poor and could not afford for her the soil of easy growth. I was a young mother. I was a distracted mother. There were other children pushing up, demanding. Her younger sister seemed all that she was not. There were years she did not want me to touch her. She kept too much in herself. Her life was such she had to keep too much in herself. My wisdom came too late. She has much to her, and probably little will come of it. She is a child of her age, of depression, of war, of fear. Let her be. So all that is in her will not bloom. But in how many does it? There is still enough left to live by. Only help her to know. Help make it so there is cause for her to know that she is more than this dress on the ironing board, helpless before the iron.
Thank you. So at the end of the story, this let her be, who is that aimed at?
I think at the teacher who called at the beginning to say, I want to help her. Will you come talk to me? Can we help her?
And why is the teacher, because I'm still a bit confused about this, why is the teacher concerned?
Well, I think that the author hints at it with the lack of concern Emily has over her midterms. So on the one hand, she is happy tonight, and she's doing well tonight. But on the other hand, she's not doing anything at school, and she's not fulfilling her potential in many ways. And the mother is saying, I don't know how to help her, and there is much in her that will not bloom because we were not able to help her. But she's also saying that is the way life is. I think the story does a great job of leaving it, you know, right in the middle. You really don't know. You don't know, just like Emily herself, she's poised. You don't know. She could go on and become a great comic and find success and happiness somehow, or she could sink into despair, and you have no guarantees. And I think that's what the story is about, that there are no guarantees, and how very poignant that is when you want so much to give all that is best to your child. I think the mother has the choice to change herself that she does not make. You know, I think the mother could say, I will come in, I will talk to you, but she feels that she cannot change anything in that. She feels it's already too late, and she might be right. You know, what I love about this story is that I think it is so wise, and it's so, you know, it gives you lives in detail without doing what a normal story does, which is a normal story will pick particular scenes out of a life. But this really, you know, kind of flows through a life and yet is able to make you feel like you understand every aspect, the true aspect, that you know more than what is on the surface.
Yeah, there's that fabulous line, isn't there? You know, I will never total it all. There's that understanding that, mm-hmm. and you sort of feel that, I mean, I've read the story now a few times, which you know when you've read a great story, that you will never total it all after reading the story, however many times. You know, you read it in one way and it's one thing, you read it another way, it's another thing, and that's the mark of a great story, I think.
I think that's such an insightful thing to say, because I was just thinking about, you know, the art of the short story and what the short story is. And I think that is so true, that, you know, a short story kind of gives you a glimpse of something, but what you really see is out of the corners of your eyes. You know, what you see in the story itself is kind of a lens, and through that lens is a huge world that a good short story will imply for you, and that, you know, that resonates you, that changes you. I think it's that's the fantastic thing about a short story, that it has the power to do that.
Well, thank you so much for giving me and the people listening to this a lens into your inspiration, your imagination. It's been really lovely. Thank you so much.
Oh, well, thank you. It has been such a pleasure from beginning to end. And thank you so much for inviting me for this, Steve.